message this morning is titled "Comforting Those in Trouble." That's our message title this morning. We've been exploring this whole subject of trials, of difficulties. I know for some of you, it's about all that you can do just to survive. You feel like you have to put everything you've got into just surviving. And then I've got the nerve to talk to you this morning about how to comfort others who are in trouble. But for some of you who are suffering right now, can I just encourage you to just try to explore something with me a little bit? For some of you, the relief will come when you start looking to help others. When Jesus hung on the cross, he thought of others. In John 19, we have recorded that he's hanging there, and his mother and John walk up, and he's concerned about his mother. Who's going to take care of her when he's gone? And here he is, he's dying on the cross. When the Apostle Paul was in prison, he didn't sit there and just feel sorry for himself. Man, he was right. Some of our favoritest letters came out of that place when he was in prison. The letter to the Philippians was written when he was in prison. And the theme to the Philippian church was to rejoice. Don't that blow your mind? Years ago, Dr. Carl Menninger of the Menninger Clinic was asked, if someone felt a nervous breakdown coming on, what would you suggest that he do? And this is his reply. And I don't know if I should do like a German accent. Well, this is what he replied. No. If you feel a nervous breakdown coming on, I would urge you to find somebody else with a problem, a serious one, and get involved with that individual, helping him solve his problem. In helping him to solve his problem, then in reality, your own problem is going to disappear. You're no longer thinking internally. You're no longer letting things gnaw at your stomach. You're no longer getting disturbed about yourself because you're not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about others. And so we want to talk this morning about comforting those in trouble. We've got communion this morning, so I've only got 4 points this morning because I want to make sure that we spend some time in communion. But I've got 4 things I want to talk about. And as we look at these things, I want to start off by, since on Wednesday night we're in the book of Job, and that's what started this whole mess of thinking about trials, I want to make sure that we learn the lessons of Job's friends. These are the guys that Job calls miserable comforters. We want to make sure that we don't do as they did. And so point number one. Here we go. How to comfort others in trials. How to comfort those in trouble. And point number one is this. Don't condemn. Be gracious. Don't condemn. Be gracious. Now, there is a place for confronting our friends about things that we know are wrong in their life. Please don't misunderstand me about this. There is a place to confront other people. I believe that's what Paul is dealing with in Ephesians 4:15 when he talks about how we grow up as Christians, and he says that we grow up when we speak the truth in love. That's how we grow up as Christians. And so when I talk about don't condemn, I'm not saying that there isn't going to be a point sometimes in our friend's life where we need to confront things with them. Yes, there's going to be times like that. But the problem when we look through the book of Job, and as those of you who've been with us on Wednesday nights, the problem with Job is that his friends didn't know what he had done. All through these horrible middle chapters that are going to take us years and years to get through. Oh, when is it going to end? All of this stuff, one thing after another, his friends are throwing stuff at him. They're accusing him of all kinds of stuff, but they don't have any evidence. It's just, well, you've got a miserable life. You must have done something wrong, and that's their premise. So they're not confronting Job in love. They're making accusations. about stuff they have not a clue about. His life, we are told, was blameless. We need to give people the benefit of the doubt. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians 13:7 that love believes all things. I think that means you give people a break. When you have a friend going through marital difficulties, for example, be careful about taking sides. Be careful about assuming that you know what's wrong, especially if your friend you know has got huge problems. You need to be careful about that, because you don't probably really know what's going on. Be careful about condemning people when you aren't in their shoes. A biology professor took a small group of young biologists into the desert for intensive study. Miles from civilization, the vehicle in which they were traveling broke down. The group set out on foot on an estimated 3-day trek back to their campus. After 2 days of hard travel, they reached the summit of a huge sand dune. Thirsty and sunburned, they looked around them. Far off to their right was what appeared to be a lake with small trees around it. The students jumped and screamed for joy. But the teacher, who had been often in that area, knew that they were seeing a mirage. He presented the bad news to them, sharing the facts as best he could, but insisting their eyes could not deceive them, the students rebelled. Unable to convince them of their error, the professor permitted them to head off in the direction of the alleged lake, while he would take another course. He made them promise that after they had discovered it was a mirage, they would sit down and wait for him to return with help. About 3 hours later, the students arrived at a plush new desert resort, which had 4 swimming pools and 6 restaurants. 2 hours after they set out in a land, 2 hours after that, they set out in a Land Rover with rangers to search for their teacher, and he was never found. That was supposed to be a punchline. You know what? Sometimes what you think you have assumed about the other person may not be right. That's the problem over and over about Job's friends. God will even confront them and say, "What? You guys don't even know what you're talking about." Do you know someone who is struggling? Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." That means when you're merciful to someone else, you get it back. Do you know someone who's struggling? Have you figured out their problem and why they are in their mess? Look at Hebrews chapter 12, verse 12. The book of Hebrews was written for people who are going through tough times, people going through very difficult circumstances. And we've already spent some time in Hebrews 12 as we've been talking about trials. But here in chapter 12, verse 12, we get some instruction that some of it relates to how we treat others. And I think because of the context, he's talking about how we treat others who are going through difficult times. He says in Hebrews 12:12, he says, "Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Look diligently, lest any man fail or fall from or of either fail of the grace or fall from the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." Now, this I contemplating making this about 5 points in itself, and I just decided to just boil it down to this. I kind of circled these words: verse 12, lift up; verse 14, follow peace; and verse 15, grace. see our relationships with people can impact them. And we ought to be lifting up people's hands, not slapping them in the face. We need to pursue peaceful relationships with people. He says in verse 15, to be careful that anybody doesn't fall from the grace of God and that a root of bitterness springs up. And I kind of wonder, as I mean, I spent way too much time on these verses yesterday, and but as I was looking at this, I couldn't help but wonder sometimes. See what people need in their tough times. They need God's grace. They need God's touch, God's kindness, God's mercy, God's love. And yet sometimes we're too busy slapping them around and trying to fix them and straighten them up. And rather than being able to grab a hold of grace, the God's grace, the person becomes bitter. Don't condemn. Be gracious. We're reading this morning in the book of Ruth. When Naomi, the book of Ruth is a story about a gal named Naomi. And she's married to a guy named Elimelech. They have two sons, and they fall in hard times, and they move their family out to Moab, another country. And while they're in Moab, the boys get married, and then more tragedy strikes. Her husband dies, the two sons die, and it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. She becomes very bitter towards God. Remember, Hebrews said, don't let this root of bitterness spring up. Naomi became very bitter towards God. She says in chapter 1, verse 20, she said unto them, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. For the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. Naomi became despondent, bitter over her circumstances. And who wouldn't blame her? She's lost her husband. She's lost her two sons. When her and one of the daughters-in-law, Ruth, when they came back to Israel, they came back to the little town of Bethlehem. I could imagine what kind of criticism they might have faced. I mean, my gosh, Naomi, what a faithless woman. Why did you go to Moab in the first place? Those Moabites are horrible heathen people. I mean, no wonder you made your bed, now lie in it. You know, it's just your problem, and there you go. I think about how many times I've said that to people or thought it. And when they settle into Bethlehem, Ruth goes out to try to get some food. And being poor, being widows, they're allowed to what we call glean in the fields and pick up the leftovers behind the harvesters. And she finds herself, just happens to find herself in the field of a man named Boaz. And Boaz is a, you know, he finds out about this gal and says, oh, hey, everybody, let this gal, help this gal out. I mean, let's help this gal. And in Ruth 2:10, it says, she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, why have I found grace in thine eyes, but thou shouldest take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger? Don't condemn. Be gracious. How do I help those in trouble? Don't condemn. Be gracious. Huge things happen in the book of Ruth. Lives are transformed in the book of Ruth. And I just want to consider maybe a little bit of it has to do with the grace that is shown. Point number two. Be careful about defending God. Now, we've talked about this on Wednesday nights. This has been something that we've seen over and over in the book of Job. There are times in the book of Job where Job's friends feel like, well, the friends come and they try to comfort Job and they sit there for 7 days in silence, you know, and that's good. And they're just, you know, there for their friend. And then, see, the problem is Job opens up his mouth and he starts complaining. And boy, he is good at complaining. Job is really good at complaining. And it just kind of irritates the guys because, like, how dare you say this kind of stuff? I mean, you're like talking about God. And, like, we can't let you talk about God like this. And so they feel like they have to defend God. They will speak much truth. They are experts at apologetics in not a good way. They know a lot of truth. I've heard them described as porcupine theologians. They have many fine points, but you can't get too close to them. So we need to be careful about defending God. At the end of the story, God will rebuke the friends. In Job 42:7, it says, "The Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath.'" You haven't spoken correctly about me. We've talked about how, when Jesus was being arrested in the garden, Peter felt like he needed to defend the Lord, and so he whips out his sword and he starts swinging, and he actually makes contact with somebody, lops the ear off of this guy named Malchus, who's the high priest's slave, and there's this guy going whoa, and his ear's laying on the ground, and blood's coming out, and how do you think Jesus responded? Whoa, Peter, good shot, dude. You could aim a little lower, though, next time. You know, swipe this way instead of this way, you know. Or just, oh, well, thank you, Peter. You know what? This is how Jesus responded. He said in Matthew 26:52, Jesus said to him, "Put up your sword in its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that thus it must be?" Pal, I need to go through this. Dr. Luke is the only one that records that Jesus reaches out and touches Malchus and heals him. We think this is the last known recorded miracle of Jesus before his death, fixing a mistake that one of his disciples made by swinging his sword too much. Sometimes we too are a bit too quick, if we're not careful, us porcupine theologians. Sometimes we're a bit too quick to whip out our Bibles and try to lop people's heads off. We need to be careful about that. Now, please don't misunderstand me here. We must be ready to give answers to people who want to know about the Lord. The study of apologetics to be able to defend the faith is very important. 1 Peter 3:15 says that we should be always ready to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you, and do it with meekness and with fear. But the problem is that sometimes when we are reaching out to a person who's going through a tough time, the problem is that too often we react to just the words that are coming out, the complaining. And you know what? Complaining, I don't like to listen to complaining. I want to stop that. You know what? I don't like to hear this stuff. You know, it's like a squeaky violin. Stop it, you know. You know what? Sometimes we need to be a little bit slower to speak. Don't be so quick to respond to their words. Learn to respond to their needs. And if you don't know what their needs are, wait till you find out. Do you hear me? Be careful about defending God. Be careful about it. Number three. Oh, I'm afraid to offend some people here. Number three. Be a friend, not a parent. Be a friend, not a parent. Not a parent. Say that again. Be a friend, not a mother. Now that doesn't quite sound good, does it? That's why I said don't be a parent. Some of what doesn't work with Job and his friends is they're pushing their age and their wisdom on Job. In Job 15:9, they say to him, "What knowest thou that we know not? What understandest thou which is not in us? With us are both the gray-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father." I mean, pal, we know what to tell you. We know how to tell you what's wrong in your life. Someone once said, I wish I could have found the actual quote, because I'm going to probably butcher this, but this is very important. I think this is very good. Somebody said this: when an older man and a younger man are together, the older man should never bring up his age and wisdom, and the younger man should never forget it. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? When it comes to friends who have problems, some of us have learned very well how to be a mother or be a father because, hey, we're a mother and a father. You know, I got kids. I know how to be a parent. I do that three times over. I do that, you know. But not everyone needs for you to be their mother or father. Some people need you to be their friend. Are you hearing me on this? Are you hearing with the difference that I'm talking about? Do you know the difference between a mother and a father and a friend? Now, parents, I'm not saying stop being a parent to your kids. That's not. I'm not even going there. Don't do that. But I'm talking about with your friends. A newlywed farmer and his wife were visited by her mother, who immediately demanded an inspection of the place. The father had genuinely tried to be friendly to his new mother-in-law, hoping that it could be a friendly, non-antagonistic relationship. To no avail, she kept nagging them at every opportunity, demanding changes, offering unwanted advice, and making life unbearable to the farmer and his new bride. While they were walking through the barn, the farmer's mule suddenly reared up and kicked the mother-in-law in the head, killing her instantly. At the funeral service a few days later, the farmer stood near the casket and greeted folks as they walked by. The pastor noticed that whenever a woman would whisper something to the farmer, he would nod his head yes and say something. Whenever a man walked by and whispered to the farmer, however, he would shake his head no and mumble a reply. Very curious as to this bizarre behavior, the pastor later asked the farmer what that was all about. The farmer replied, "The women would say, 'What a terrible tragedy,' and I would nod my head and say, 'Yes, it was.' The men would ask, 'Can I borrow that mule?' And I would shake my head and say, 'Can't, it's all booked up for a year.'" When you are helping, your friends, are you making them wish they could borrow the farmer's mule? Do you hear what I'm saying? What I'm so afraid is with this point is that the ones who need to hear this won't get it. Your friends may not need your advice. They may need you to weep a little more with them. The Bible says in Romans 12, "Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep." Before you go offering advice, Let me ask you this. Have you wept with your friend? Have they asked for advice? And I'm not saying you don't ever give advice. You may really have some answers for them. Do you hear what I'm saying? Don't be a friend, not a parent. Number four, last point. How do I help those in trials? Point number four is endure your trials. How do I comfort those in difficulty? Number four is endure your trials. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 3. Paul says, blessed be God, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3, blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. In other words, I'm so thankful for the comfort that God gives us, and that God even allows us to take the same comfort and to comfort other people who are going through the same thing. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, we have plenty of trouble, plenty of suffering. He says, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. As many troubles as I have just as much comfort. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation or your comfort and salvation, which is effectual in the enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And our hope of you is steadfast, knowing that as ye are partakers of the sufferings, so shall ye be also of the consolation or the comfort. Paul says, I am confident that just as you're going through the same things, and though you're going through the same troubles, I am confident you will also receive God's comfort. For we would not, brethren, have you be ignorant of our trouble, which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God, which raiseth the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and doth deliver, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us. Paul's teaching the Corinthians that when they go through trials and receive comfort, that they'll be able to turn around and give that same comfort to other people. Trials ought to teach us to have compassion on others. Charles Spurgeon tells a story about a man who was a chief justice in the common person's court, and this man went out on a walking tour one day out among the commoners, and as he was out walking with a friend, they walked by a place where the stocks were. Now, we're not talking the NASDAQ stocks. We're talking about, you know, the stocks where you stick your hands in and your neck in and stuff. And the Chief Justice just kind of got to wondering, I wonder what it's like. And he said to his friend, put me in this thing. I'm just curious what it's like, because after all, he'd handed out sentences before for people to be put into the stocks, and so he sticks his neck in there and his hands in there, and his friend was kind of a doofus, because the guy brought along a book, and the guy was just kind of really, really more interested in the book, and he, you know, locked his friend in, and then started reading his book and walked off, left the Chief Justice there in the stocks. Well, one of the townspeople walked by, and the guy's struggling to get out and says, "Oh, did you? Good day, man. Please release me from this." And the commoner said, "Oh, well, sir, you must be in there for some reason. I can't let you out." And the guy was in there for hours until finally some other friend came and go, "What are you doing here?" and let the guy out. Well, later, this chief justice presided at a trial in which another lawyer, a magistrate, was charged with false imprisonment and by putting people in the stocks for the wrong reason. The lawyer, the attorney for the magistrate, kind of made joke about it, about how, you know, sitting in the stocks was really no big deal. It's no real punishment. The chief justice rose and he leaned over the bench and he said in a half-whisper, "Brother, have you ever been in the stocks?"
"Oh, really, my lord? Never."
"Well, I have," said the judge, "and I assure you it's no such trifle as you making it out to be. If you want to comfort others in their trials, you know what? You need to go through yours. And you need to find out that God is faithful and able to comfort you. You need to go through your trials. Sometimes," here's where I've been a little convicted lately, "sometimes we try a little too hard to live a comfortable life. I think for a few of us, if we were to be honest about our goals and ambitions in life, one of our ambitions is to live a comfortable life. No problems, no troubles. Personally, I've been kind of examining my own heart. I think this is one of the reasons why at times I'm reluctant to share my faith with others, because it makes me uncomfortable. Last week, George Bryson did a marvelous job laying a guilt trip on me, didn't he, about going to Russia? He didn't do it second service, he did it first service. Laid a huge guilt trip on me. And I almost didn't want to go because he laid a guilt trip on me. But as I began to examine my heart this week, I know the real reason why I'm reluctant to go to Russia. Because I'm scared. I've never been out of the country. Well, I went to Tijuana once. Mom and Dad took us to Tijuana once, and we went up to British Columbia to, Butchart Gardens and all that, you know. Yeah, right. And I began to examine my own heart and realized, hey, I'm only reluctant because I'm afraid, and I'm afraid because I don't want to be uncomfortable. Well, I'm going to Russia. I'm going to go to Russia because I know God has challenged me. I want to say something. I'll say it twice. God doesn't want us to be comfortable. He wants us to be comforted. You get that? God doesn't want us to be comfortable. He wants us to be comforted. I am only comforted when I go through my tough things and I cry out to God and I find that He is faithful and He is there and He will help me through. But don't ask for to be comfortable. That's not what God desires for us. I think there's times where God is all about making us uncomfortable so that we'll grab onto Him. Trust God in your trial. I think the greatest help that you can offer to your friends is to be able to say to them, "You know what? Boy, do I feel for you. I know I have a little bit idea what you're going through. And I want to share with you, just as Paul shares in Corinthians, man, I've been there, and I have come to find that God is faithful, and He will help you. I am confident that He will help you. I think sometimes we run into a danger where we confuse sympathy and comfort. I think the danger is that when we are sharing with a friend who's going through a trial, I think sometimes sympathy can be dangerous because we're trying to show them how much we care about them, which is not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But the end result is that the person comes to look to us for their comfort rather than to God. And you know what? I can comfort a little bit, and we ought to comfort a little bit. Let it be there. But you know what? The comfort that I can give you is nothing compared to the comfort that God has for them. We need to point to Jesus. Hebrews 4:15 is where we want to, I just want to end with this, and then we'll take communion. Hebrews 4:15. The writer says this, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." Jesus knows what you're going through. Jesus knows what your friend is going through. He says, "Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Let's pray as we prepare our hearts for communion.